Have you ever been so busy that you were like, I wish I had an intern? I've been there, between grad school and driving to all 50 states. Well, thanks to GenM, now you can. GenM offers you an apprentice for 90 days to help with your business, no matter if it's a startup or a podcast. You can search for apprentices based on skills, languages, and countries, and swipe through countless options to find the perfect person to help you grow your business. I'm such a fan of my apprentice that I'm offering everyone who signs up $10 off for clicking the link in the bio of the episode. So what are you waiting for? Start looking for a teammate today. Hello and welcome to a special episode. This special episode is brought to you by the incredible amounts of work that I have leading up to the deadline, September 20th, for my work at University of Oxford. So for those of you who don't know how this project started, I had this thesis project that I had to do at Oxford, and I proposed going to all 50 states and writing some sort of book about it. I expect them to sort of help me hone it down, help me figure out something a little more manageable, but instead they rubber stamped it and said, all right, go ahead. So I had to write this book and I had to go to all 50 states. And for those of you who are listening, I thought I'd share the opening of the book that sort of started this whole project. We're going to be taking a little break from releasing new episodes. We've got one special episode on the way about a conversation with someone who's lived in Antarctica. I don't know. In the meantime, I thought I'd share the opening chapter of 50 States of Mind and would love to get some feedback from people about what they think about the inciting incident that led me on a journey through all 50 states. So here it is, the opening chapter or prologue of 50 States of Mind. Prologue. The voters were angry, and I was part of the problem. It was October 26th, 2016. Even though it was fall, the Florida heat was oppressive on that dusty afternoon at Palm Beach State College. I was a field organizer for the Hillary Clinton campaign, and had spent the day placating thousands of angry Hillary supporters at what should have been a joyous occasion, a birthday rally for our candidate. Instead, I was being sworn at, cried to, and pleaded with for bottles of water. The afternoon sun was reaching its peak, blazing down on the sprawling queue of people who had expected to be inside the rally, seeing the next president of the United States. I had worn a polyester turquoise blazer under the assumption that it would match Hillary's signature teal pantsuit at the staff's post-rally meet and greet, but the initial thrill of the outfit stunt had evaporated. I stripped off my sweat-drenched blazer and tossed it next to a chain-link fence as I ran to find water for a woman who had fainted. What did a picture inside with Hillary really matter when people out here were collapsing with heatstroke? After all, I had met Hillary, once at a staff meet and greet in Iowa and again at a rally in New York, where she had approached me backstage for a friendly chat after she heard a senior staffer hiss, "Wallpaper, don't be seen, don't be heard," at me. Hillary was cool like that, the principal of your school who goes out of her way to learn your name. The opportunity to see her in person was a reminder of why I worked 14-hour days, 7 days a week, but suddenly I was hit with more pressing issues, like finding water for her most vulnerable supporters, left out in the sun. Over the past 2 years, I had left my life in New York City and returned to my small-town roots with a job on the campaign trail. Originally from Rockford, Illinois, a Rust Belt town in the Midwest, I felt at home in rural and overlooked parts of the country. I loved organizing teams of volunteers, from dairy farmers in Iowa to Haitian immigrants in Florida. Over the past year, I had spoken to disaffected Democrats, but no Republicans, since the campaign's strategy was to turn out our base, not reach out to those with whom we disagreed. The voters seemed to think differently than the strategists in Brooklyn anticipated, however. Today was a perfect example. How could so many thousands of people at a Hillary event be so angry? Florida was a critical swing state. 537 votes had sealed George W. Bush's victory there in 2000, handing him the presidency, and subsequent Florida presidential contests were decided by a mere few hundred thousand votes, making it a necessary stop 13 days before the election. The Palm Beach County staff were told about the rally the week of the event, and it was exactly the kick we needed as we prepared to cross the finish line. Our region had been performing so well that the campaign had sent us staffing surveys for administration jobs in Washington, meaning that none of us were going to miss a trick at the closely watched event. Our region's first instruction was to call every voter in our universe, the roughly 14,000 people identified by our database as having strong Democratic leanings in the area. These calls, usually done by volunteers, were conducted by staff because of the importance of the event. We rang the universe and extended a very special invitation to Hillary's 69th birthday rally. A typical conversation went along these lines. Hello, is Edna there? Who is this? Hey, Edna, it's Ryan from the Hillary campaign. I've told you to take me off your list 4 times now. I'm not coming to volunteer. Stop calling me. Well, Edna, we're actually not calling you to volunteer. We're calling to tell you we have a very special guest coming to Palm Beach County. Even my fiercest phone foes were so over the moon that Hillary was coming that I felt momentarily vindicated for months of daily solicitation. However, the next day, they were reminded why they dreaded our calls. Hillary's campaign headquarters sent orders down from their tower in Brooklyn to our tiny roadside office adjacent to a car wash. Confirm. 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 We needed to lock down commitments and numbers, so we repeatedly phoned the attendees, ensuring they were a yes in the RSVP column. The next day, we called them back. Just checking you can still attend the rally on Wednesday. They all still could. The next day, again, just checking nothing's changed and we'll see you there. I felt like the mother of the bride from hell, but I told myself that these voters must have been flattered to receive so much attention. Since when had someone made me RSVP 5 times to a birthday party? The day of the event arrived. All of us on staff turned up bleary-eyed in the college parking lot at dawn. We were expecting crowds in the high thousands now that word had spread. Hundreds of people had already gathered to get the best glimpse of Hillary. The sun was ascending, lighting the cloudless Florida sky with an optimistic, rosy glow. It was going to be a beautiful day. As I walked towards the football stadium, I said to my boss, "Lucky we're going to have such nice weather today." She shrugged. "Doesn't matter either way. The rally's in the gymnasium." She was referring to an indoor basketball court not much larger than that of a mid-sized public high school. I didn't understand. "But that only seats 1,000 people." She shook her head. 800. The stage takes up a lot of space. I looked back at the ever-growing line. "So why the hell did we invite five-figure crowds if less than a tenth are going to get in?" She stared as though the answer was obvious. "The news coverage. We want to show really big lines outside of the event, show that people are excited about Hillary." I wasn't the first person to realize the problem. A woman with a walker, her daughter toting a lawn chair so her mom could sit down, knew the gymnasium could only host a fraction of the crowd waiting outside. "Are we going to get in?" "I don't know," I said honestly. I was quickly admonished by the advance team. "Tell everyone they are getting in, and get them to sign up for phone and door-knocking shifts while they wait." I felt tricked. Over the past few months, I'd become close with my volunteers, the Floridians who gave their time without pay. In line, I saw Chip and Debbie, who made calls to show solidarity with their gay son in Fort Lauderdale. I saw Kim, who rode the bus an hour every day to do one door-knocking shift, even though she was on disability. I saw Elaine and Karen, an older couple who did all the paperwork and data entry. The people I had personally invited weren't just my region's volunteer leaders. After all the hours spent together, I considered them a sort of family. I had convinced them to pledge hundreds of volunteer hours for the cause, and now they'd be waiting in line for an event I knew they would not be able to attend. All for what? Optics? It was now 10 in the morning. The event was slated to begin at 11. It would not. These events often started hours late. The line snaked back around the entire grounds of the college, and I estimated that there must be thousands waiting. I was right about one thing. It was definitely a beautiful Florida day. It was also becoming an extremely hot, beautiful Florida day. Our job was now to convince the antsy crowd to sign up for volunteer shifts, and if they didn't, they would certainly be contacted by text, email, or phone until they did. The question on all of their lips, "Am I gonna see Hillary?" I couldn't bring myself to lie. I hope so. I really do. As morning turned to afternoon, my impassioned pitch to sign up for volunteer shifts continued. By this time, we had run out of water, and I had overheard the phrase heatstroke more than a handful of times. I called out people in the crowd and explained the importance of every vote in Florida, but the heat was getting unbearable, and I was starting to be interrupted by people who saw the way the tide was turning. "I took my daughter out of school for the day," one mom begged, sweat beating on her forehead. "Please, can she go in?" "I took my one vacation day from the factory," said a man central casting would have pegged as a Trump supporter. "I want to see my girl Hillary." But nothing broke my heart as much as the elderly woman with her daughter who, instead of complaining, simply asked for a bottle of water. "I'm just not used to being outside for this long."
As the afternoon wore on, people became angrier and angrier, and as they shouted at me, I found myself agreeing with them. You called me 5 times. You emailed me twice. I RSVP'd each time. I've been out here waiting the sun since 8 a.m., and I asked if I'd get in, and you said yes. If you'd said no, it would have been fine. I would have left. Now it's 1:30. This is why people don't like politicians, said a woman, tears in her eyes. It's messed up. I nodded. You're right. It's messed up. I thought back to my optimistic first months with the campaign, coaxing Iowans into caucusing for Hillary by telling the story of how I had quit my job in entertainment and moved to Iowa to work for a woman who truly cares about all Americans. If only Iowa Ryan could see me now, sunburnt, drenched in sweat, and ruining everybody's day. It was 2 o'clock and the sun was at full power when the campaign finally devised a strategy to placate angry voters. The overflow section, my boss gleefully announced. You can watch Hillary talk on a big projection screen right outside the venue. It'll be just like being inside. This was met with jeers from the crowd. I could have stayed at home and watched her on TV, you idiot. Do you realize how much a day off costs me? However, soon the overflow section was overflowed. 800 had made it inside. 500 had made it into the overflow section. There were thousands of people left outside the event. They'd waited hours for nothing. I couldn't think of who was to blame. Was Brooklyn's decision to lure these people here cynical, or was it just a poorly thought out policy? Was it my boss's fault for refusing to level with people, or was it my fault for following orders rather than telling the voters to go home? The arms of the bureaucracy were confusing to me, even though I was a part of it. One thing was certain, the needs of the people on the ground were not the campaign's main priority. By mid-afternoon, Hillary made a quick sweep outside to acknowledge those remaining overflow voters, returned inside, and the rally began. The doors were firmly shut. The organizers were not invited into the rally, although we saw from Instagram that our regional director, absent for the past few hours, had miraculously snagged a spot right inside next to the stage, amidst a sea of signs declaring, "I'm with her," as if to further remind those outside that they were not. We waited until the crowd dissipated. The promised meeting with Hillary was the only thing to look forward to, until it wasn't. Hillary and her advance team canceled our meet and greet. We watched as a blur of teal pantsuit left the building surrounded by security, stepped into a black SUV, and sped away. Good to see you, Hillary. That night, we watched the news coverage, hoping at least to see the sprawling crowds waiting for Hillary to counter Trump's raucous rallies. This was, after all, the point of the entire event. Instead, the news coverage was shot inside the gymnasium, early in the morning as the first Hillary supporters trickled into the empty bleachers. Not much excitement here at the Lake Worth Hillary rally, a reporter smirked. For those of us watching, this was the final straw. They know that's not true, I said to my coworker, aghast at the duplicity. Not surprised, she returned to her computer. Fake news. After the event, sunburned, angry, hungry, disappointed, and dejected, we returned to the office. Kim, one of my volunteers, was there waiting. She had taken the bus all the way to the rally, but she hadn't gotten in to see HRC. She didn't yell about the lack of water. She didn't complain about waiting for hours in the blazing sun. All she asked was, "They'll still vote, right?" As Kim left, I looked around the office covered in Stronger Together posters and cardboard Hillary cutouts, as though I was seeing it for the first time. The system was so clearly broken. The day's mistreatment of voters was so antithetical to everything I believed politics could or should be. This wasn't the first time I realized something was wrong. But it was the time I was closest to punching a cardboard Hillary cutout across the office. My coworkers began venting. We were working for a cause we were meant to believe in, but instead of doing something productive for these communities, we were being paid to lie to voters for media coverage. This was democracy in America? We riffed and fed off of each other's frustration until finally I pointed an accusing finger at cardboard Hillary against the wall. If this is how your team treats voters, you deserve to lose. This was 2 days before the Comey letter, 2 weeks before the election, and 2 years before I set off on a journey through all 50 states to listen to what American voters had to say about what had gone wrong in our democracy. Okay, so that's the opening of 50 States of Mind. And the reason I chose to start with this anecdote is not because this book is about Hillary or Trump or 2016 at all, really. It's about the erosion of our democracy. And I think that anecdote really illustrates the loss of focus on what politics is for and who politics serves. It's not about getting headlines. It's not about getting retweets. It's not about the optics. It's about the people.
and their day-to-day life. And if we're prioritizing optics over the people, there's a problem. And so looking at things from a macro level in our democracy and these trends that we have, partially probably because social media, you know, you're not present in the moment always. You're wondering how it's going to look to your followers. There's this lack of authenticity and presence and prioritization of the people who are actually in your community and around you. And that's really what the book's all about. It's about what we can do in the here and now, in the present, to make people's lives better and make a difference. So that anecdote hopefully illustrates that. And I also think it's very important for someone who's reading the book who might not agree with me, might not have voted for Hillary, who might not have experience with progressive or democratic politics, to see that, you know, it's important to be self-critical. It's not a one side is blameless thing. I mean, there's definitely blame on both sides, but it's important to be self-critical of your own team or your own party. And hopefully that sort of self-critique will continue throughout the book as I visit different communities and showcase the really great things that are going on, but also maybe where, as citizens, we've sort of gone wrong a little bit or lost focus. So if you enjoyed this, send me an email, Ryan, R-Y-A-N, at 5050statesofmind.org. That's Ryan at 50statesofmind.org. And again, we're going to be wrapping up this season with a great episode about Antarctica. But if you want to hear more chapters from the book, I'm getting it done by October 31st. So if you want to hear chapter 1, chapter 2, chapter 3, let me know. And I see no reason why I can't read them out. It actually really helps me a lot to hear what works and what doesn't out loud. So thank you so much for listening. It's been a great season. And I think in the future, we're going to have even more great guests, maybe some more presidential candidates, and keep talking about this thing that is our democracy.